We look. We buy. It is ours. Ours to consume, to sell again, perhaps to give away. More often, ours to keep. We look, we buy, and we collect valuable objects. But the most valuable object of all has become the oil painting.
I'm Billy Flanagan. The program is Art of the Insane. It's our surrealism edition. And it's time once again for us to settle down together and move on with your quest. It's your quest to turn out expensive and valuable art canvases at home in a half an hour or so. Canvases that have the real look and feel of the kind of collectible art of the insane that usually has clowns in it. Although I have pretty much made my reputation on not falling for the clown gamut, because I see it as a cheap trick and one suitable only for aging actresses or lounge singers or others who need desperately to get on TV. With paintings that are not authentically insane, they're just cute or affecting. There's nothing like a crying... Well, don't get me started. They all look like they have knives, you know? Well, today we're going to discuss subject matter because that's where the real insanity factor can come into play. Even if you can't paint a lick or even if you lick your paints. And if you do lick your paints, don't do it to the cinnabar, the red. That stuff will take your tongue and mail it to Taiwan on a stick, if you get my drift. So what shall I paint, you says to yourself, rolling your eyes to the ceiling. Grab the moment. See, there's an insane metaphor I just came up with, and what am I going to do? Rolling your eyes to the ceiling. I'm going to turn it into a high-priced collectible tramp art of the insane. I said collectible. I suppose I mean collectible. Sounds sort of like testicle, doesn't it? Well, I've got my canvas. We showed you last week how to pee on it. And here it's a pretend week later, although it's only a TV half hour, which you can tell by the awful smell still here in the studio if you were here, which of course you aren't. And lucky for you, too. Okay, first, I'm going to do the eyes because the ceiling, see, will be orange, and I like to get the orange stirred up good. Let's just stir it up with an anvil, I think it is. Luther, would you stir it up there? Eyes are round. I'm using a color. Doesn't matter which. They're pretty much all the same. And we put in these dots in the eyes, whatever they're called, eyeballs or something like that. Then we go back across the studio here and hurl the orange from over here. Looks pretty much like one more sport here. Here we go. Looks just like Taiwan to me. Now, those smudges could be palm trees. They might be ducks. But that's the kind of insane ambiguity we want. I'll do the stick with this color. You remember I said, mail it to Taiwan on a stick. This is the stick part. It's a wonderful color, that one. I don't know what it's called. I suppose it has a name. Who cares, really? Painting in the stick's a little harder. I'm going to use my palette. Oh, you caught me there, didn't you? You think I meant my palette knife and that I'd made a mistake, and that's where you'd be as wrong as a doorknob on a donut. I'm going to take my entire palette with the thumb, see, that goes right through the little hole for the thumb, and I put it right here, and I start swirling it around, and then I sit on it, and I swirl my elegant buttocks around, and I take a look, I stand back, not too far back, or I'd be off camera. That wouldn't be much of a TV show, would it? Well, there you go. Looks just as surreal as if Tristan Tzara himself had swirled his butt on it. And it's worth a lot more to some collector who himself is insane to be collecting the art of the insane. Well, we're about to run out of music, so we'll see you next week. And we'll discuss the kind of expensive and collectible folk art made of bottles and slag that you can turn into a drive-in chapel or grotto and sell postcards and live like a prince in a small Airstream trailer on the grounds.
Oil paintings often depict things which in reality are buyable. To paint a thing and put it on a canvas is not unlike buying it and putting it in your house. The objects within the painting often appear as tangible as those outside it. If you buy a painting, you buy also the look of the thing it represents. Paintings often show treasures, but paintings have become treasures themselves. Art galleries are like palaces, but they are also like banks.
At Tonto's First Cowboy Bank, you can use your sidekick card at any one of our conveniently located money holes.
Howdy, Deputy.
Hi.
Insert your sidekick card in my holster, please.
Sure, here.
Gee, I'm sorry to tell you. Your account is overdrawn $79.55.
Oh, gee.
Stick 'em up.
Hey, put that gun away, huh?
Now, empty your pockets into my money bag.
Sure, here.
Thank you. 84 cents in change, 3 bus tokens, and a rooster head contraceptive.
Give me back my contraceptive.
You're still short $78.44. How about that watch?
Oh, my dad gave me this. Oh, okay, here.
A Rolex.
Yeah, a Rolex.
No, this is a North Korean ripoff of a Rolex worth only $28. Let's have that class ring on your finger.
I was going to sell this at the 23 Union. All right.
Dave. Worth $41.
You bet.
Not bad.
Not good.
Another $9 and you're out of here.
Now, what do you want, my shoes?
Give me your shoes.
Oh, all right. Here, take them.
Half a hair's Boston Trail Thumpers. Last year's model. Too bad, partner. Only worth $4. How about that t-shirt?
Oh, no, not my tour sh... Oh, I take it.
You're in luck. A White Brains on Toast Third Farewell Tour tank top. That's a collector's item worth $16. You're in the black. Now, skedaddle, partner. Damn!
Hey, crazy droid!
When they shut for the night, they are guarded, lest the images of the things which are desirable are stolen. The value of paintings has become mysterious. Where, we ask ourselves, does this value come from? Those who write about art, or talk, or teach about it, often raise art above life, turning it into a kind of religion.
Hello there, dear friends. I'm Reverend Billy Barnstormer. I'm so darn glad to be with you again. Thank goodness, and you can say thank goodness for that. I want to tell you now about my recent trip down to Kentucky, where I went to the Creationism exhibit, and what a thrill that was, my dear friends. Now, I will admit that at first I was mite concerned that it was a museum. I don't know whether you realize that the word museum comes from them nine muses. These are Greek goddesses who tempted men into making great works of art, wonderful scientific discoveries, you understand, but just to seduce them, just to seduce them into the sin of pride. That's what the museum, the muses was. And these museums here are where they can show off their prideful, supposed man-made knowledge. And, well, I'm just going to leave that because people now talk about museums as what they is, not what they really mean. So I just want you to know that from Reverend Billy Barnstormer. Well,
consider, for instance, the ways in which the space of the modern art gallery presents the visitor with nothing less than an iconographic program and a master historical narrative. By walking through the museum, the visitor will be prompted to internalize the values and beliefs written into the script, art history which claims to account for these objects and their changes over time.
There is no man-made knowledge whatsoever, no siree, at the Creationism exhibit. Nope. And everything there is scriptural. It's based on God's word. And it is a magnificent building, I have to tell you. Just take a look at here. And every room, there's a catastrophe. There's almost an apocalypse in every single room. Adam and Eve's fall is there in the first room, and the great flood with Noah and his ark, of course, and the fall of Babylon, a modern godless society like you see around you right now. And there's a nice little bookstore right there at the end where you can buy a Bible, and you can buy it in many colors, too, I want you to know. They're white-bound and blue and black. But anyway, if anything, the Creationism Museum I thought was too timid, let me say, presenting its theories as possible explanations instead of saying exactly what it was, God's own eternal truthiness, standing up against your millions of heathen scientists who try to convince you. Centuries of enlightenment, so-called knowledge. Well, here at the Creationism Museum, you can find the real knowledge. It predates the Bronze Age when they started making the swords and killing people, and even the invention of the wheels. Let me just tell you about one of the exhibits here. That's the dinosaur exhibit. Oh, my friends. The dinosaurs, of course, was before the fall of Adam and Eve. And they show you there how the big, fierce Tyrannosaurus, he ate grass in those blessed days long ago. And I'm sure my parishioners all know there was no death. Now, before the fall of Adam and Eve, all the animals, they was vegetarians because they didn't eat one another. Now, I'm sure you know that before the great flood, there was still these dinosaurs, and they actually, and they show you this there, they actually helped build the ark by biting into them giant trees they had back then with their big ugly teeth, and they knocked down those trees there for Noah to build the ark. They show you all about that. And dinosaurs are really exciting, and you can ask any so-called paleontologist what those dinosaurs used their teeth for, and they ain't going to tell you that because they don't know what the truth is, dear friends. Well, I want to advise you to go down there to Kentucky. You want to bring the whole family, bring the kids. They're going to love playing with these friendly dinosaurs, just as Cain and Abel did in their time, dear friends, when they were little children. And, I'd like to give it 4 yabba-dabba-doos out of 4. Well, this is Reverend Billy Barnes-Dormer. It's always wonderful visiting with you. And I'll see you down there in Kentucky at the museum. You look for me down there in the dinosaur room. Thank you, dear friends.
In the first of these programs, I tried to show how and why modern methods of reproduction and communication, like color photography, like television, have theoretically changed the meaning of the visual art of the past, demystifying it and making it secular. But mostly those who use these new methods of reproduction and communication, those who write books or make television programs about art, tend to cling to the old approach. Art remains something sacred. A love of art seems automatically to be offered as a sublime human experience. If the experience of art is sublime, it looks as though it can be sublimely independent of a lot of other values. So perhaps we should be somewhat wary of a love of art. You cannot explain anything in history, not even in art history, by a love of art. Let us look at a painting whose subject is an art lover. This picture, which shows a 17th century patron surrounded by his collection, tells us more about Europe and painting from the Renaissance onwards than hundreds of art books or essays on aesthetics. What does it show? The sort of man for whom painters painted their paintings. What are these paintings? Before they are anything else, they are objects which can be bought and owned. Unique objects. A patron cannot be surrounded by music or poems in the same way as he is surrounded by his pictures. Does this special ownership of pictures engender a special kind of pride? It is as though he lives in a house built of paintings. What is their advantage over walls of stone or wood? They show him sights. There are many different subjects, but what the pictures all have in common is that they are painted with oil paint.
This is C. William Bob Hebelhauser speaking, and speaking damn well. Why? Well, because you got to have confidence in yourself and in your beloved country. And so here I am speaking up and having confidence in things I, like you, don't have any real confidence in at all, including my beloved country. God bless it. Now, as the president of an automobile mega manufacturer, you'd think I'd be just pleased at the hot kiss at the end of a wet fist to see my beloved but hard to be confident about country just enslaved to the gills by its stunning dependence on oil. But you'd be wrong to think so, and I'd be wrong to try to tell you so, and here's the reason why. It's pure and simply that we're living off the greasy, oily remains of the dead. That's right, that stuff you're pouring into your car, both the black stuff and the clear stuff that comes out of the pump, including that transmission purpley stuff and the steering fluid, whatever the hell that is, as if a fluid could steer anything. It all comes from the dead and decomposing ghoulish deposits of dead dinosaurs and their attendant little fronds and ferns and gigantic boo-goo trees, now sunk beneath the earth and pressed into evil-smelling liquids that might make your car go like a greased monkey on a slick shark, but which at the same time enslave us to dependence on greasy little guys in foreign lands with God knows what wrapped around their heads. Well, it's time to rise up on our hind legs and figure this out. Like erect men and not slimy, dead, oily deposits of bastards who'd eat you if they could figure out how to establish themselves as living, breathing oil. Well, you get the point. This is C. William Bob Hebelhauser, and I'm just plain pissed off.
From about 1500 to 1900, the visual arts of Europe were dominated by the oil painting, the easel picture. This kind of painting had never been used anywhere else in the world before. The tradition of oil painting was made up of hundreds of thousands of unremarkable works, hung all over the walls of galleries and private houses, rather in the same way as the reserve collection is still hung in the National Gallery. If, as we are normally taught to do, we emphasize the genius of the few and concentrate only on the exceptional works, we will misunderstand what the tradition was really about. European oil painting, unlike the art of other civilizations and periods, placed a unique emphasis on the tangibility, the solidity, the texture, the weight, the graspability of what was depicted. What was real was what you could put your hands on. The idea that a thing is only real if you can pick it up may be connected with the idea of taking a thing to pieces to see how it works.
Elmer with a good name. He fixes in like watches and clocks, and he's one of the few people that knows how to, because he's kind of self-taught, and he's done this his whole adult life. People send him antique clocks from all over the place because
really?
He's the only dude who knows how to take apart a clock, figure it doesn't matter what the mechanism is. He takes it apart, figures out how it's supposed to work, what's wrong.
So he's like a very specialized person. Like, does he do museum pieces and stuff? And they send, like, is he world renowned?
The premier of the province of Saskatchewan called him to come fix the clock that the province of Quebec had given to Saskatchewan as a gift in 1906 or something.
And was this just something like you see him around when you were a kid? Did you see him taking things apart?
Yeah.
Oh, that was his.
And apparently my parents always said with him, from the time he was a kid, if you gave him a little toy, he'd just take it apart.
Yeah.
That was his first thing he'd do. He didn't even want to play with it. Take it apart, see how the hell it worked.
At the beginning of the tradition of oil painting, the emphasis on the real being solid was part of a scientific attitude. But the emphasis on the real being solid, on being what you could put your hands on, became equally closely connected with a sense of ownership. These scientific instruments were used for navigation. They were painted at the time when the world trade routes to Europe were being opened up by the heroic voyages which we learnt about in school, bringing European civilization to the rest of the world. It tends to be forgotten that these voyages were the start of the European slave trade and the traffic which began to siphon the riches of the rest of the world into Europe.
And we took to them.
And they took to us.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
Christopher Columbus wrote from Jamaica, "Gold is a wonderful thing. By means of gold, one can even get souls into paradise."
Buenos dias, amigo.
Hello, you must be the true white brother.
Sure, you must be the Indians.
Yes.
Welcome home. Welcome to New Spain. This is your new father, Father Corona.
Down on your knees now. Do you recognize what I'm holding over your heads, lads?
It's a cross. The symbol of the quartering of the universe into active and passive principles.
God have mercy on their heathen souls.
What the Father means is, what is the cross made of? Gold. Have you got any?
No.
What about the seven cities of gold? Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas?
This is gold.
What's that?
Corn.
Hey, corn! Now we can make tortillas!
We've been waiting for this for hundreds of years.
I just invented tacos!
So this is all you got?
Yes, but... Aren't you the true white brother who's supposed to come and live with us in peace?
Sure. Therefore, I claim this rich world and a pasture land in the name of the Empire of Spain.
Hey, Capitano, the rain, she's a stopping to fall, and the corn, she's all dead.
Shut up, Vespucci. I claim this stinking desert in the name of the Empire of Spain forever. Let's go.
God bless Vespucci land.
Oh, by the way, Domini, you're all Catholics now. God bless you.
Come on, and Father. Nobody in their right mind would live in this stinking desert.
Come on, Cisco.
In 1519, Magellan set out to sail round the world. He and an astronomer friend with whom he had planned the voyage were to keep 20% of the profits made and the right to run the government of any land they discovered and conquered. This globe charts Magellan's voyage round the world. Beside it is a book of arithmetic, a hymn book, and a lute. To conquer a land, it was always necessary to convert it to Christianity. The picture was painted in 1533 by Holbein. It shows two French diplomats in London. The picture is about science, about navigation, about diplomacy, about power. But in the way that it has been painted, in the way that it has been seen, what is it most about? There is not a surface in this picture which does not denote wealth. There is not a surface which has not been elaborately and skillfully worked. Except for their faces and hands, every square inch of the canvas has been gone over numerous times by weavers, embroiderers, carpet makers, mosaic makers, leather workers, furriers, jewelers, and last of all, by Holbein the painter. They are two men convinced that the world is there to furnish their residence in it. The seafaring instruments have been placed on an eastern carpet. Without the first, the second would not be there. Implicit in the rise of European Christian culture was the destruction of other cultures. But the Europeans saw it differently. They believed that their civilization was in all respects more advanced than any other. The African kneels to hold up an oil painting to his master. The painting he is holding depicts the castle above one of the principal centers of the West African slave trade.
Oh, Uncle Tom! You're back!
Uncle Field Marshal Thomas Lawbury, quadroon, honey! I'm back! And I'm beautiful!
I'm so glad that you're back, Tom!
It's good to have you.
See, there are many, many things that you don't know.
That's
everything
right,
you know is wrong.
I forgot! You're a free man now!
This is the best
part
of
the I ain't, General. How's this? Pencil has a professional slave. Well, now, you've been walking over this kicky old government for over 60 years, and now you plan to pay your puppet tax. Put it right here in the bag.
Blasphemy! I die first.
Honey, nobody gwan have to be a slave all the time, no more. We gwan take turns, and guess who's doing it in now?
Many works of art in other cultures and periods have celebrated wealth and power. Gods, princes, and dynasties were worshipped. But these works were static, ritualistic, hierarchic, symbolic. They celebrated a social or divine order. The European oil painting served a different kind of wealth. It glorified not a static order of things, but the ability to buy and furnish and to own. Before the invention of oil painting, medieval European painters often used gold leaf in their pictures. Afterwards, gold disappeared from their paintings and was only used for their frames. But sometimes the paintings themselves were simple demonstrations of what gold, of what money could buy.
What this country needs is a little more golden rule and a little less rule of gold.
A certain kind of oil painting celebrated merchandise in a way that had never happened before in the history of art. Merchandise became the actual principal subject of these works. Eating is a pleasure. But these paintings cannot be eaten. They are a demonstration of something else. First of all, of the artist's virtuosity. Secondly, of the owner's wealth. Livestock. Not animals in their natural condition, but animals whose pedigree is emphasized and whose pedigree is a proof of their value. Whose pedigree emphasizes the social pedigree of their owners. They are painted like pieces of furniture. A table or chair with four legs. Portraits were equally important. Portraits of the owners of the paintings, and the owners of much else besides.
This is the portrait gallery.
This is the portrait.
There's an echo in here. This is the portrait gallery, Nick. It's the safest room in the mansion. Mm. No one can find us here.
All right, Nancy. Get your hands off me.
These paintings did not directly celebrate what was buyable. They were records of the confidence of those to whom ownership brought confidence. Those who could buy banquets, horses, bulls, houses, hung on their walls generations of portraits painted to celebrate a continuity of power and worthiness. There were hundreds of thousands of such portraits, but those they depicted represented an exceedingly small fraction of the population. The poor have neither annals nor portraits. Their lives are unrecorded.
We were small, angry men with hairy faces and burning feet. We were running away from poverty, intolerance, and the law
and the army.
But again, the style with which the average portrait was painted reveals something about the basis of this confidence and of this so-called dignity of the sitter. They were painted as though they were a strange mixture of livestock, furniture, and tailor's dummies. Every portrait is a record which says, I once existed and looked like this. These portraits say, in addition, I was an object of respect and envy. I had only to raise my hand to receive attention. Everybody's clothes indicate social status. But the clothes and feathers and jewelry of these women make exaggerated claims. It is their clothes, not their faces, which dazzle. The faces of women in many European paintings are like the faces of swimmers in seas of silk and satin.
William Cudlip Penisnose, the last mayor of Billville, found himself clinging to the top of the flagpole, surrounded by a vast body of rising water. He said, I'm finished in politics because I don't have the votes, and I can't go into wrestling because I don't have a mask. Guess I'll just swim, swim, swim. Oh, I'm just a little fishy floating in the sea, and there ain't no hook that's smart enough to catch the likes of me. La 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 la, la 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 la.
Oil painting could paint these materials as they had never before been painted. There were also paintings whose subjects were taken from classical literature, subjects which today seem quite remote, unsubstantial, dreamlike. But this wasn't so when the pictures were bought. Classical mythology was part of the specialized knowledge of the privileged minority. And these paintings helped them to visualize themselves whilst displaying the classic virtues, making the classic gestures. The paintings were the settings for charades in which they themselves would play. The props were given. The spirit of the performance was left to the owner's imagination. But we should not confuse these exceptional paintings, and everything in the museums, everything said by art experts encourages this confusion. We should not confuse such exceptional works with the purpose and significance of the general tradition. Two self-portraits by Rembrandt. One when he was young, one when he was old. But the difference between them isn't just a question of how age changes a man's character. In the first painting, Rembrandt used the style and methods of the tradition for their traditional purposes, as an advertisement for the owner's good fortune, prestige, and wealth. In the later painting, he has turned the tradition against itself. All has gone, except a sense of the question of existence as a question.
To be or not to be.
Intermittently, the tradition can breed within itself a counter-tradition. But the basic values of the tradition win in the end. This painting now has a fabulous price on its head, perhaps £3 million. It has itself become a fabulous object of property. Of course, a lot more can be said about European oil painting than I have said. Yet what I have tried to show is a fundamental part of the truth which is usually ignored. We study other cultures far away as anthropology. That's to say, we study them from the outside. We don't judge them purely according to their own explanations of themselves.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the wonderful world of travel and adventure, the Golden Hind. Come with us as we visit strange places and people the wide world over. Hi, friends. I'm Bob Hind. Today I'd like you to meet two of my dearest friends, George and Ida Matetsky.
Good evening.
Hello there.
Well, George, you're just back from a really wonderful trip to, where was it?
To New Guinea.
That's right, to New Guinea. And I understand that you and your lovely wife have brought back some beautiful color films for us to see here.
Yes, that's right.
Well, and we're going to let you tell us all about it. But first, let's get them on the screen here. What are those, Ida? Are those natives?
Yes, Bob. This is on the Orinoco River, probably the largest river in the vicinity.
Ah, and those towers, those are the ones you were telling me about, aren't they, George?
Yes, they are. Oh, they're centuries.
Oh, and that one looks a little different. What is that?
Yes, Bob, that one doesn't have a bottom.
Oh, George, will you ever forget those romantic clam fishermen?
No, I don't.
Why, some of those clams, Ida, they're as big as your hand.
Yes, Bob, you know that one on the left almost nipped off Ida's hand.
Oh, well, that was a close one. We'll be back to part two of The Golden Hind.
Now, if we look at the culture of the European oil painting in the same spirit, leaving aside its own claims for itself, I believe we will find that oil painting was, before everything else, a medium which celebrated private possessions.
Sometimes we own the zeros, and sometimes we own the ones.
Hey, there's a 10 in my soup.
Sometimes we own your shoes, and sometimes we own your souls.
It's like walking on a cloud of fresh pork.
Sometimes we own your mind, but we're always in your thoughts.
It's a pig that looks like a locomotive and tastes like flowers.
What do we own?
Souls?
Minds?
Pork?
Kind of. We're US Plus. We own the idea of America.